This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Signature support for Talk Louisiana comes from Brian Lowe Financial. 877-217-5757 is your number. And our email is talk@talklouisiana.org. I'm sure some of us remember Monday, not so long ago, just about 72 hours ago. And on that day, we were preempted for the first half of our show by the President of the United States, who was commenting about the tragedies in El Paso and Dayton, Ohio. And we interviewed Rose Hudson of the Lottery, and that interview will air tomorrow. The Lottery is one of the entities in state government doing very well, and it has been around since 1991 under Charles E. Buddy Romer. And as we know, the Lottery has been productive ever since, and this past fiscal year, which ended the 30th day of June, produced record revenues, and it also meant that $184 million was transferred from the state of Louisiana to K through 12 education. And this is something that is notable, and Rose Hudson comments about it. 877-217-5757 is your number, and we should be hearing from C. Denise Marcel, the state representative from Baton Rouge, former Metro Councilwoman, in a moment, and we're going to talk with her, if things go according to plan, about crime. And, of course, Baton Rouge is one of the most murderous places in the United States, as is New Orleans. And because of that, Louisiana, every year, over the last 30 years or so, has been number one in the nation in murders per capita. Now, Louisiana, according to the FBI crime stats, the last year of complete information, 2017, and we discussed this a bit yesterday with Mark Walters, we rank number one, 12.4 murders per, I think that's 10,000 people each year in our state. And 12.4 last year, as bad as that is, it was 17.5 per capita in Louisiana per 10,000 in the year of 1996. But number two in the nation behind us is Missouri, 9.8. So you can see Louisiana is way ahead of anybody else in the state in this most dubious of categories, and we rarely talk about it. And it's something that our congressional delegation certainly doesn't ever speak of. And six members of the U.S. House and five of them have dug in and say they don't even want background checks to be required at gun shows. What do you think? 877-217-5757 is your number. And we're going to go to C. Denise Marcel. We're going to get her take about what Baton Rouge has been like in the 3 years since the Alton Sterling death. But before we get there, Louisiana, primarily because of Baton Rouge and New Orleans, is the most murderous place in the United States of America, the state of Louisiana, is C. Denise Marcel. And yet, as I mentioned, I don't know that any of our lawmakers talk about this, and few of them probably know it. Why are we not focusing more on this?
Good morning. Are you speaking to me, Jim?
I am.
Hi, how are you? I'm not really sure of why the murder rate in Baton Rouge is kind of being swept under the rug, but I think it needs to, we need to give more attention to it. We need to find out the root causes of it and kind of get to the bottom of it. I think the numbers are rising. They are certainly alarming to me.
Well, I'm talking about the state of Louisiana, and obviously it's number one in the state, and Baton Rouge is right there among the cities of comparable size as far as the murder rate per capita, higher than Chicago, by the way, certainly higher than New York City, higher than Los Angeles, and New Orleans is even worse, and yet we largely pretend this doesn't happen. And we've, as Garrett Graves said the other day, the congressman, we've got 400 million guns in America. And most members of our congressional delegation and the state office holders, state legislators, they believe that having lots of guns is okay, that as long as we can keep them out of the hands of the bad guys. But how can we keep them out of the hands of the bad guys without in some way impeding the rights of the good guys?
Well, for one thing, we definitely need to implement the red flag laws that we propose. But, you know, for me, I proposed some legislation last session, which was to ban the bumps. And what people need to understand is we understand the Second Amendment right to bear arms, but at the same time, who goes hunting with an AK-47? Why do we need military-style guns on our streets where they can harm our children and our elderly? And just general, it looks like it's just general population now. And so I believe that you're going to see a lot of movement with these recent mass killings that have happened in terms of that. Because the average citizen are just tired of just prayers and condolences. That does no good to a family when you're just sitting in a theater and your loved one is shot, or you were sitting at a bar and your loved one is shot by someone who has a high-powered weapon. And that is the problem.
Well, those high-powered weapons not so long ago were banned in this country, but now they are available. And not only is there no movement from any of the GOP lawmakers, to my knowledge, other than the governor of Ohio who just embraced this terrible tragedy, there's no sentiment in Congress because Mitch McConnell is sitting on a bill that all it would do is expand background checks. Five members of our delegation voted against it. So is anything really going to be done? What does it take after something like happened over the weekend? How much does it take for people to get the message?
To get it. I totally agree with you, Jim. I'm not sure what it's going to take, but I believe that since this happened, I think we'll see some movement. I understand that our delegation has voted against it. And a lot, if you talk to some of the lawmakers outside of those rooms, outside of the votes, they know that that's not the right thing to do, but they're voting along with their party. And we've got to get out of that. This is not about parties, but this is about people. And so when we lose one more life, that's just too many lives that we're losing. I mean, it's like we have a war on our streets. And the other thing is that it protects law enforcement, and they never talk about that. Why should law enforcement be faced with someone with that kind of a weapon? And so we all times talk about protecting our the men in blue, but how do we do that when the person on the street has a weapon comparable to theirs, or in many cases, outpower their weapon, because they're not walking around with AK-47s?
All right. Well, the number I gave, that 12.4, which is number one in the nation and second in the nation in this dubious category, Missouri 9.8. That's murders per 10,000 people in 1 year. So if you live 80 years and do the math on this, 80 times 12.4 is 992. That's almost 1,000 out of 10,000. That's almost 10%. That means if you live in Louisiana, you've got a 10% chance over the course of your life of dying in a homicide.
By gunfire. Right. That's outrageous.
877-217-5757. Dan downtown. Dan, good morning. You're on Talk Louisiana.
Yeah, Ms. Marcel, as for the cause of the high murder rate, could there be a correlation between the $1 million the NRA gave Senator Cassidy and whatever the rest of the Republicans in Congress got, all of whom oppose any kind of gun control?
Senator Cassidy, he got over a million. But does money talk, or do these people take their money and then vote another way?
I believe that money talks. You know, especially when I was at the state capitol this last session, the NRA was in the building, and they control these legislators. I mean, it is unreal. But what I don't understand is the general public that continues to go to the polls and vote against their own interests and put these people back in office. I mean, for me, it's not about an R, it's not about a D, it's not about independence. It should be nonpartisan. It should be about the P, which is the people. And so you're absolutely correct. The NRA pours money into these campaigns, and you get scorecards. I don't care if I continue to get an F from them. For me, it's about protecting our citizens, our children, and our people in this nation.
877-217-5757. Denise Marcel with us for another segment. And before we go to our 90-second break, Representative, you are a victim of gun violence. Of violence,
well,
let's say violent crime.
A violent crime, correct.
And you have lived to survive it, but have a pacemaker to show for it, if I remember correctly.
Well, I have a defibrillator.
Okay, that's even more high-powered, a defibrillator like Dick Cheney. But she's still with us, and she'll be with us for another segment if you'd like to join the conversation. 877-217-5757. We're back after this brief pause on Talk Louisiana. This is Jim Eakster. Thank you for joining us. And C. Denise Marcel, State Representative, Democrat, Baton Rouge, is with us. And Baton Rouge Police Chief Murphy Paul last week apologized to communities of color in our city for his department's contributions to the climate of mistrust between residents and police that reached a boiling point in the aftermath of Alton Sterling's death at the hands of then Baton Rouge Police Officer Blaine Salamone on the 5th of July, 2016. Denise Marcel, is this over and done with? Is time to move on to another chapter, or do we need to revisit this?
I think it's time to move on to another chapter in terms of Salamone. I know some recent things that came out about him stopping the paramedics from helping someone who was dying on the ground. That just solidifies that what Chief Paul said was accurate. And so we have rid ourselves of this individual. I think for the most part the Baton Rouge City Police are great officers, but we need to get rid of the bad apples. As we continue to get rid of the bad apples, we need to support our chief.
Former Police Chief Pat Inglade condemned Murphy Paul's comments, questioning why the current chief didn't mention officers who were killed in the weeks after Sterling's death when a lone gunman ambushed Baton Rouge law enforcement officers on the 17th of July. That was 12 days after Sterling's death. That was a terrible tragedy. This man, Gavin Long, was killed by sharpshooters. But those officers
that
should
was
be.
A they terrible tragedy.
It was a terrible tragedy, and it would not have happened had the Sterling thing not occurred, the Sterling death. So should we remember Montrell Jackson and Matthew Gerald and Brad Garofalo?
I think we should remember them, and I don't think the chief's comments in any way deliberately had any reflection on him not thinking about those officers. I think that he was speaking directly to what Salamone had done and not getting away from the Alton Sterling thing and painting the whole picture. I think everyone in this city was outraged by what happened to Montrell Jackson and the other officers that were killed, and we were all outraged by it. But for the fact that Salamone would have handled that situation differently when he approached it, but for the fact that he should have never been on the force, perhaps we wouldn't even be here having this conversation today, because people in the department had said that he was hot-headed, he was going to kill someone. And so we have to look at those entire facts. I certainly don't want any officer to be killed or anyone else to be killed again. And we have to call it what it is.
Well,
I think that's what the chief did.
Murphy Paul, of course, is an appointee largely through the mayor, who generally chooses the police chief. And he is popular in some quarters, unpopular in others. He's being blamed probably, and I'm almost certainly unfairly, for low pay among Baton Rouge police. That was there long before Sharon Weston Broome took office or Murphy Paul became chief. But it would seem, Denise Marcel, that more people might be interested in becoming police officers if the pay were better.
And, you know, Jim, we fought for higher pay, and I will, you know, any time that I have the opportunity to raise the pay for police officers at the state level, we do so. the problem that we've had, even in the state, as you know, when we took it over, there was a deficit. And so you can't pay police officers something that you don't have. Do they deserve higher pay? Absolutely. Would many of us do the job that they do and put our lives on the line every day for the salary? I think not. So most officers that do it for the love of their community, and they want to protect and serve. And so, yes, I do believe that the pay should be higher. How do we get there? I don't think we can get there overnight, and it's certainly not Chief Paul's fault, because, as you said, he found it this way. I mean, that's the same thing they're talking about with the governor. We were in a deficit. We were in a hole when we took over. When I took office, I could not provide something when we were digging ourselves out of a hole that Jindal put us in.
Chuck,
nobody wants to say that.
Okay, well, Chuck writes, and this is the broader topic, he writes saying, if you think the founding fathers who came up with the Second Amendment knew what was going to happen in the future, you're dumb as the day is long. These weapons of war need to be removed from our streets now. If we do a national recall of these weapons, it will take 100 years for this to stop. But we want, because one's right to have fun on the weekend outweighs everyone else's right to live in peace. If you think it's video games or BS like that causing these events, you're willfully ignorant as well. Enough ranting about something that will never change. Remember, duck and roll when you hear the shots. That's from Chuck. And I think Chuck echoes most Americans. In fact, 94% of Americans are in favor of background checks. 94%. But yet nothing is being done about this. And our congressional delegation takes its contributions from the National Rifle Association and then votes exactly the way the NRA wants them to. Are we going to have background checks, Denise Marcel? A very modest move, by the way.
Let me say that I'm optimistic that we will have background checks. I think that the American people, such as the gentleman that just wrote in to you, are really tired of condolences and prayers, and they should demand action. And when people don't vote the way they should, we should go to the polls and send them home and put someone else there. But the problem is that it takes a lot of money to run these seats, right, to win these seats. And so they pour so much money into these races that the people that will best represent the citizens don't get a chance most of the time. And so we need to start supporting those candidates financially and however we can, and especially with our vote.
John in New Roads, he says President Trump, I'm paraphrasing him, is endeavoring to run a race next year against outspoken African-American females such as yourself. John may be right. There are more white men in this country than there are black women. But is this the way to unite our country?
Well, I think we unite our country by putting someone in our president to head our country that really has the best interest of the people. I don't care if you're black, white, blue, or green. We need to put somebody there that's not divisive, that does not flame white supremacy, that does not say that these are some good people when they're doing these types of acts. And so you promoting hate is a problem. It doesn't matter to me if he was green. The problem we have with uniting our country is the fact that we have a president who's divisive. And so as long as we have a president that is divisive, we will continue to see the killings and the things that we're seeing now, because the hate is spewing all over our country and it's coming straight from the White House. And so for me, I believe that we have a better chance at getting that diversity once we remove President Trump.
All right. Well, today in the New York Times, which, of course, has not been a friend to the president in its reporting about his past, the Times, it's on page A11, but notes that the president's popularity level has increased from 34%. That's what it was on Election Day, by the way, in 2016. He won an election in which only 34% of the people liked him. It's 44% now. And so he may very well be better positioned now than he was 3 years ago to win an election. And for people who are writing him off, I think they're maybe sadly wrong. This man may be headed for another 5.5 years in the Oval Office, Denise Marcel. Does that comfort you, or does that give you pause?
That gives me great pause. I mean, it's a shame on us if we do that. And, you know, what's the strangest thing about that is we don't get it until it hits our house. Why does my child have to be killed with a high-powered weapon or from someone who's feeling hate or someone that you know or someone that's related to you for you to get it?
All right. Well, thank you, Denise Marcel. And a listener notes that President Obama tried to change gun laws and failed, so the president can't do it unilaterally. And President Trump, of course, has a different opinion on any number of things than his predecessor did. We'll return with Mark Ballard, Capital Bureau Chief from The Advocate, 877-217-5757, your number. Now the news. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Matt Doyle is producing, and our guest, as is our Thursday custom, is Mark Ballard, Capital Bureau Chief for The Advocate. 877-217-5757 is your number. And let's start with qualifying. This year it's Tuesday through Thursday. Usually it's Wednesday through Friday, but it means that in a few hours, as in about 7.5 hours, we'll know who's on the ballot for October 12th. And Mark, so far, no real major surprises. What do you think?
Well, of course, we have a history in Louisiana of having exciting last days of qualifying. So, but as of this morning, nothing really jumps out. We have Ralph Abraham and Eddie Rasponi as the two major Republicans running against Governor John Bel Edwards. He's picked up a couple of, he picked up a Democratic opponent in the governor's race, and Gary Landrieu, who is running without party affiliation, is also in there. And then there's four other Republicans in there as well. But I think the takeaway from all of this is that you're looking at the other statewides. Lieutenant Governor Nungesser has nobody running against him. Kyle Ordoin is running against primarily the woman that he beat last time, and then there's another woman that joined in. And really surprising is the Attorney General, Jeff Landry. He has nobody running against him, which means that if that stays the course for the rest of the day, that he may play a big role in the governor's race as well. Schroeder has... the person that the treasurer Schroeder has the person that he beat last year or 2 years ago, and then the only real competitive race that we're looking at is for the insurance commissioner, Jim Donlan, who's I think three times he's running for his fourth reelection.
Yeah, he is. He'll be the longest serving insurance commissioner if he serves out another term.
Indeed,
but
he's facing
Republican.
A Republican insurance man who's put about $1 million into the race. So this may be the first time he's actually really had to run a race since 2006.
Well, it looks as though the Democratic Party is on life support when it comes to these statewide offices. It's very difficult. And how does this affect the governor? If he has no Democratic friends on the ballot with him, does it potentially make him more vulnerable than he otherwise would be?
Well, I think that's a good point, and it's a fair analysis. The Democrats seem to be sitting out for this election for the most part. Governor Edwards, unlike Governor Blanco, has not really built up a bench. He doesn't really have coattails. He hasn't been able to bring in any other Democrats into elected office. And so, I mean, what this will end up being is a Democrat at the top of the ticket and then Republicans all the way down. And it could be problematic for those that vote, and there's a considerable number that vote straight party ticket.
Mm-hmm. And a listener, Holly in the Garden District, asks about next year. Bill Cassidy will be running for reelection, and By all odds, he should have a competitive race, one in which he would be the favorite, but you would think it's a six-year term, for goodness sakes. So you'd think somebody would sign up to run against him. I wonder if a Democrat will do that, any substantial Democrat.
And, yeah, that would be a reasonable wonder, I think. I mean, who would be able to mount a statewide race right now other than Governor Edwards? I think that Senator Cassidy's problem in re-election is going to be coming from the right, and it'll be and you've been seeing his policy has been shifting more and more to the right over the last year or so, but I think that's where his problem area is going to come, that, you know, he's not conservative enough.
Maybe David Vitter will run against him.
Perhaps. Let's start that rumor here.
877-217-5757, your number for Mark Ballard. John in Livingston. Hello, John.
Good morning. I think I heard Mark say that Jeff Landry is going to be not have any opposition, which is a big surprise. I wonder if Mark can help us understand why a lightning rod like Landry wouldn't have any opposition. And I'm wondering when Mark's comment about how Landry might then play a larger role in the governor's election. I didn't exactly understand what he meant by that.
Yeah, Landry's raised a lot of money, and he may not have to spend any of it. He could then use it and potentially help a Republican running against John Bel Edwards. What do you think?
Well, Jeff Landry, the attorney general, has been probably the biggest thorn in Governor Edwards' side since he was elected in the last 4 years of this term. And without a major Democrat kind of holding him down, without him having to focus on his own reelection, that'll free him up to to try to get more conservative Republican members of the state legislature, which is he's the head of that group that is aiming for that. And secondly, it'll free him up to start taking shots at the governor during the campaign. And I think that, you know, we'll be seeing that. Now, why there's no Democrats, I guess I could go back to what I said earlier, is that under Governor Edwards, there's not been really much effort to kind of strengthen the bench. And so the prominent Democrats, there are very few, and you can, like, count them on one hand almost. And they're just not willing to take a run against what would be a very harsh campaign, and then there's a good very likely possibility of losing, because this is an overwhelmingly Republican state.
A listener notes, this is Tracy at the Capitol, that Gene Reynolds was thought to be running against, I think, Jeff Landry, but it did not happen, or it has not happened yet. What happened there?
I remember that he retired from running the state parks just 5 or 6 months ago. I had heard that rumor as well. But the man's in his mid-70s, and maybe he just, you know, doesn't want to take on that task.
He could have also run against Billy Nungesser. And remember, Billy Nungesser received just over 54% of the votes against Kip Holden. Kip Holden will go down until further notice as the African-American to receive the biggest percentage of votes in the history of Louisiana in any election, and any statewide election. And they've trotted out all these oldies but goldies, but I don't see Kip Holden getting ready to run for lieutenant governor again.
I don't. You need to, as far as Gene Reynolds is concerned, that Nungesser was the one who hired him to run the state parks. So, I mean, I don't know the dynamics of all of that, I'm not seeing that he would be joining that race. And would Kip Holden run again? I don't know.
I don't think so. He'll turn, 67 on the 12th, which will be Monday, and we wish him well. Three-term mayor of Baton Rouge, but I think he's done and ran a very poor race against Cedric Richmond. And Cedric Richmond, very quietly, Mark, he has become a player on Capitol Hill as a Democrat, and he's the only one voting his way, which is the way Democrats vote. And all the Republicans on almost every vote, they vote exactly the same, if they're all there to vote. And we saw that in evidence with Garrett Graves on Monday at the press club. He's a very attractive candidate, and I mean he's physically a good-looking guy. He's articulate. He's passionate. But yet he is an ideologue. There's no doubt that he is as right as any member of Congress right now, and some people thought he might be different considering that he's representing a district that used to be a competitive district. But what's gotten into Congressman Graves?
Well, I think used to be is the key phrase there, because in 2010, his district was redrawn to become more white and more Republican. And so, I mean, one could argue that he's representing the majority of his constituents there. But he does follow along the party line.
And if he were to occasionally criticize the president, he would become a national figure. He's choosing not to do that. But people who think being in Congress is a big deal, I saw Richard Baker a few years ago in a restaurant in Baton Rouge. And here's a man who served 22 years as the congressman in that same district, Mark, and nobody knew who the hell he was. It could have been anybody walking in. They didn't know who Richard Baker was at Sullivan Steakhouse.
Well, that is one thing that Congressman Graves has done well, and that is, and to his credit, is to get out in the community and to spend a lot of time talking with constituents.
877-217-5757 in our remaining time with Mark Ballard, Capitol Bureau Chief from The Advocate, who's been spending a lot of time at the Secretary of State's office. And let's see if we can slide a call in before we part company with Mark. David in Atlanta. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Good morning, everyone. You know, Rosalind Carter said Ronald Reagan made us feel comfortable with our prejudices. And if you don't think many of these Trump supporters are prejudiced, just ask yourself this question. If, say, Barack Obama, a black man, would have waltzed through the dressing room of the Miss Teen America pageant to watch teenage girls dress and undress as Trump bragged about on the Howard Stern show, just ask yourself, what would the Trump lovers be saying if that would have been Barack Obama?
That's a fair question, and President Trump did brag about that on the Howard Stern show. Said when you own the pageant, you can go back and inspect, as he called it. I have a feeling that the reaction would have been much different had it been President Obama.
I don't disagree at all. I don't disagree at all.
But nobody in Louisiana on the right side of the political spectrum will take on the president, and I presume it's because he, if polls are accurate, remains popular, and he got a lot of votes, 58%, over 1,100,000 in 2016. Mark, until further notice, he's king of the hill in Louisiana if you're in the GOP. Mark Ballard, thank you for joining us. We'll call on you next week. Always a pleasure. Take care, my friend.
All right. Thank you. Bye-bye.
See you. Bye-bye. And we'll return after this pause with historian Douglas Waller. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana, and we're joined by Douglas Waller. He's the former correspondent for Newsweek and Time, where he covered the CIA, Pentagon, State Department, White House, and Congress, the author of bestsellers Wild Bill Donovan, Big Red, and The Commandos, as well as the critically acclaimed Disciples and A Question of Loyalty. His latest work, Lincoln's Spies, Their Secret War to Save a Nation. It is on sale as we speak, and it is a big read about a big topic and one that has been perhaps largely ignored. Tell us about the book's four spies, Douglas Waller.
The four spies in this book are Alan Pinkerton, Lafayette Baker, George Sharp, and Elizabeth Van Loo. Alan Pinkerton was a famed detective back then, and he became George McClellan's spy master for the Army of the Potomac. Turned out to be a failure as a military intelligence officer. He fed McClellan wildly inflated numbers for Confederate troops the general faced. The next spy, Lafayette Baker, kind of think of him as Lincoln's J. Edgar Hoover, only with a few differences. Baker really didn't know or didn't have much dealing with Lincoln, and he was also far more corrupt than Hoover. He led a counter-espionage force in Washington, put a lot of people in jail, but also shook the money tree, and he took a lot of bribes. The third agent is George Sharp, who was a regimental commander and began heading up the spy agency for the Army of the Potomac in early 1863. Sharp was a very well-read and highly educated New York lawyer who actually created a concept that's known today among CIA folks called all-source intelligence, where he raked in not only information from his secret agents, but also from deserter interviews, cavalry scout information, balloonist, whatever, and created very readable and highly accurate intelligence reports to the Union Army that outpaced anything the Confederates had. Our fourth spy was Elizabeth Van Loo, a Virginia heiress in Richmond, who set up an espionage ring there that Confederate agents were never able to crack. Van Loo, who had this visceral hatred of slavery and everything about secession, had a group of agents. Some of them were, you know, friends or fellow unionists. Some of them worked inside the Confederate government that by the time Ulysses Grant was laying siege to Richmond, they were providing Grant three intelligence reports a week. Van Loo also incidentally sent her Richmond newspapers, plus a rose from her garden with each delivery, which Grant thought was kind of a nice touch.
Lincoln Spies from Simon & Schuster, Their Secret War to Save a Nation from Douglas Waller. And you say, and I think it's apparent, the phone tapping, human collection, and aerial snooping of today in the spy community, its genesis can be traced to the Civil War.
Well, it really can, and that's what I found fascinating about the project. So, you know, you had the you know, traditional cloak and dagger work of agents infiltrating into enemy territory to steal secrets. But for this war, you had a revolution of warfighting technology and also the technology of military intelligence. So, for example, you know, there was the telegraph now used to connect battlefields with the War Department and their generals to provide rapid communications. Well, each side tried to tap the other side's lines. Today, that's called SIGINT for signal intelligence, and each side started developing primitive codes to encipher their messages. You had balloons being used primarily by the Union, which are a forerunner of the aerial reconnaissance, the spy satellites we see today. George Sharp even used aerial propaganda at one point. He had his men fly kites over Confederate positions and drop leaflets to convince them convince them to defect, which actually proved fairly effective. So a lot of the things you see the CIA doing today were done in a more primitive sense back during the Civil War.
Yeah, we didn't have aerial photography and that sort of thing, but what was the process of intelligence collection during the Civil War?
Well, it was kind of hit or miss. Lincoln never had a centralized intelligence service. Each Union general was expected to form his own spy agency, and these were generals that weren't really trained in the dark arts. So the Army of the Potomac, which was the army that fought the battles in the Eastern Theater, a very important theater of the war, you saw the closest to a spy master there with people like Alan Pinkerton and George Sharp. But even so, they were all kind of a makeshift, catch-as-you-catch-can organization. There was no cadre of seasoned intelligence officers. They simply weren't trained. They weren't trained at West Point. So they had to kind of learn as you go.
When I said aerial photography, we didn't have satellite transmission and that sort of thing, but in the Civil War, they were using hydrogen gas-filled balloons. How did this work, particularly on the Union side?
The balloons would ascend about 1,000 feet. Somewhat primitive in their communications, there would be an aeronaut dangling in a wicker basket below the balloon, and he would shout what he saw down to the ground, or he'd have flag signals to signal it, or sometimes they'd string a telegraph line and he'd tap out what he saw in Morse code. There was even a Philadelphia inventor who proposed at one point what 150 years later would be called an aerial drone. His idea was to have a small balloon take up a camera high up and have a wire strung to it to a soldier below who would trigger the lens to activate to take a picture. Well, a Union Army officer who reviewed the project for possible funding decided that this thing would never work because there was no way to keep the camera steady to take the photograph when it was in the air, which was probably the case back then.
What did President Lincoln think of these spies, Douglas?
He appreciated them. He, Lincoln, that Honest Abe image was really a campaign image that was created for him. He actually hated Honest Abe, that nickname. He preferred to be called Mr. Lincoln. Lincoln came into office probably one of the least experienced presidents. He had only one term in Congress and four terms in the Illinois legislature, but he was hardly a novice when it came to subterfuge and intrigue. He had used some of it as a young politician in Illinois. When he became president, he first thing he did was have the Army send him daily intelligence reports on what they knew about enemy movements. He routinely interrogated correspondents, for example, who had been in the South. Took time out of his busy schedule to do that.
Now, you're going back 150 years, and the research that is necessary for a book of this kind, and it is a mammoth and very impressive collection of research. It's not easily done when you have to go back a century and a half, is it?
No, it isn't. And what I found was, and it really, I found that when I covered the CIA, the modern CIA for Newsweek and Time magazine, that particularly in the Civil War, there were no shortage of, wild, fantastic stories out there. The true stories were the ones you really had to hunt for. A lot of this work was done in secret, so there some of the records of them were destroyed, and you have to piece it together from other documents. A lot of these secret agents wrote memoirs afterwards that were, dialed up what they had accomplished, particularly guys like Lafayette Baker and Alan Pinkerton. Elizabeth Van Loo only wrote a cryptic journal, and George Sharp wrote no memoirs. So you have to piece it together from other documents. Also, some of the memoirs of people who claimed they were spies during the war, actually, they weren't. They were just phonies, or they were con men or con women. So you had to separate out them from, the true intelligence agents. You do an awful lot of kind of investigating and second sourcing to determine what really is correct.
Now, the four spies, Douglas, that you showcased, do you have a favorite?
Yeah, I get asked that a lot. It's really hard because... it's not like being asked, which of your kids do you like the most? They were all fascinating. I mean, Alan Pinkerton was this dour, humorless individual who could actually be a tiresome prig. He was always lecturing and preaching to people about the virtues of honesty, integrity, and courage, and that sort of stuff. Lafayette Baker was fascinating because he was just a complete scoundrel. He tended to lie about himself. He didn't drink and he didn't swear. He was an avid consumer, a reader of Roman history. And so he had a very, very complicated background. George Sharp, I kind of think of him as like a George Smiley type character, very erudite. He went to attended some of the finest schools in the East, in the Northeast. Spent 4 years overseas learning French in France and working in the U.S. legation in Vienna and Rome, where he learned Italian. Elizabeth Van Loo I found to be just a true hero. She risked her life, her fortune, everything to carry out a spy ring in Richmond, in the heart of the Confederacy. It was highly dangerous work. So I guess I'm not giving you a good answer. I think I liked all four of them equally.
Well, it is a story that probably would not have been told unless Douglas Waller decided to do so, and it is a fabulous book, a major read from Simon & Schuster with great reviews, and we appreciate your time and congratulations on your work, Douglas.
Oh, thanks. It's good talking to you.
Signature support for Talk Louisiana comes from Brian Lowe Financial.